growing up on a farm turned Jo McDougal into a poet. This was a time before TV. She remembers walking around barefoot, taking in the sights and sounds of the countryside. When she finally sat down to write her memoir, she was amazed to find that the deeper she dug, the more memories emerged. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll discuss her memoir, Daddy's Money. She's a writer who knows that her life story is exactly that, a story. Her story begins on a rice farm, not in Asia, but in small town Arkansas. And the story is written in a way that's textured with the techniques of fiction, playwriting, and of course, poetry. We'll get to know the unique and compelling story of a local writer on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. In the South, the paradox of love and manners, malevolence and guilt makes the Southern psyche a snake's nest of contradictions. These are the words of a local writer who grew up on a rice farm in Arkansas and remembers a world where family legacy, love, loss, pain, and nostalgia all converge in a compelling life. Remembered. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us live is Jo McDougal, whose memoir, Daddy's Money, a memoir of farm and family, digs deep into our region and country's agrarian roots and brings us forward to modern times where values have changed, but lessons remain. Mrs. McDougal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you're a poet, and you've interspersed poetry and verse throughout this memoir about farm and family and your rural roots, and to some degree, the country's rural roots. Why did you decide to write a memoir?
Well, I thought I had a story to tell. And if writers think they have stories to tell, they're going to tell it. I think if you're going to write a memoir, you should have a unique story because there are thousands out there. A lot of them are just alike. But my story, I thought, was quite unique because, to my knowledge, no one has written about growing up on a rice farm in the United States.
It's pretty specific, as memoirs are usually want to be, pretty specific about a period in your life. Mm-hmm. Why choose the farming period? You mentioned the rice farm and the specific niche of that. Why choose that period?
Well, because that period from about four or five, when I can first remember, to when I left the farm to go to college, was the period I chose to focus on because that was the growing up years when the rice farming had such an impact on me and my ancestors, my parents and grandparents and ragtag taggle of cousins and aunts and uncles were so important.
You had a ragtag taggle of aunts, cousins, and uncles. And,
yeah.
And that sort of permeates the character of your book, Daddy's Money. What makes the memories of a kid who grew up on a rice farm different than those who maybe have harvested wheat, corn, or even ran dairy farms? What are both the subtle and substantial differences?
Well, the differences are that rice has a certain romance to it, the growing of rice. It is a very, very difficult art. All farming is an art. It's not just putting the seed in the ground and watching it grow. You got to know what you're doing. And with rice, is very different than other crops because it, for most of its growing season, must be flooded with water. So the rice farmer has to know when to flood it, when to take it off, when it boots, when it's ready for harvest. And then he must deal with the heat, the terrible heat, and the mosquitoes. The similarities are it's a grain crop like wheat. The farm life, the silence, the solitude, the absence of close neighbors, all that causes one to reflect on one's life, even as a child.
But it's different in terms of the active harvesting, the being literally waiting in the water where mosquitoes are going to be there because they love wet damp surfaces, and mm-hmm. mosquitoes are going to be in the south because it's hot and there's wet, damp surfaces there. So the character and solitude and work process is much different.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. The rice is harvested with somewhat the same kind of combine that you use with wheat, but the header is different. And the price of these combines, as all even wheat farmers know, is just terrible.
And let's talk about combines. What is a combine? And your father was one of the first in the region with the most state-of-the-art one.
Right.
Please first describe a combine.
Well, a combine combines the threshing and the harvesting of the wheat, where you used to have two machines to do that. Then those two actions were combined in what they called a combine. And it's, you know, that combine is still being used. It's been much perfected since the mid-1940s when my father bought one of the first ones on the Grand Prairie of Arkansas, in Arkansas. But it revolutionized the industry. It took away a lot of the farm labor, a lot of the transient labor, the hobos, the wonderful, colorful characters that used to come by our farm just at harvest. It took all that away, but it made it more practical.
It's similar in character to the way the cotton gin was able to separate those seeds from those.
And revolutionize that industry. Yeah.
Start us off with a passage from the first chapter of your memoir, Daddy's Money, describing growing up on a farm, a rice farm in Arkansas, with your mother and dad. Here's a scene on a farm when you're about 9 or 10. Tell us about it as you read
it. This is a scene of growing up, learning how to murder a chicken. Mother places one foot on the chicken's head and yanks. It flops a few feet in the stingy grass, blood spurting from its headless neck. I'm 9 years old, standing in the drought-bitten yard beside my mother, learning how to murder a chicken. Hold it upside down by the feet, put its head under your foot, and separate its head from its neck. Blood spatters mother's shoes and cotton stockings. She doesn't seem to know it. On this summer morning in 1944, my father herds his rusted pickup back and forth across the farm, checking a rice field, fixing a broken tractor, feeding the cows. My mother dispatches 3 or 4 more chickens and turns to me. "You do it," she says. "It's time you learned." The chicken's severed head leans against my shoe, its eyes dumbfounded. Chicken blood reproaches my bare legs. Mother murmurs her approval. "Good," she says. "But you know, next time make a quicker pull. You don't want to torture it."
That's a passage from Daddy's Money, a memoir by our guest live here in the studios, Joe McDougall, who read a passage about, as you say, murdering a chicken, but it's really killing a chicken for the purpose of eating or skinning it or taking it to market. But from your perspective, at the time, it was murder. Tell us about that.
Well, I knew when I first started thinking about writing a memoir that this would be my opening scene, because it was one of the single most important aspects of my childhood. It was such a memorable, horrible experience that I thought later in life, as I suffered losses and setbacks and problems, I would often think, you know, I can kill a chicken by removing its head from its body, by placing its head under my foot. And if I can do that, I can do anything.
And in a sense, whatever you're going through at the time, you have it better off than those poor chickens.
Well, that is a good point.
What made you, Joe McDougall, take the approach of nostalgia in the memoir, rather than one that you typically see of the self-effacing or even brutally tragic self-examination, the approach we see in most popular memoirs, and frankly, that saturates the market for memoirs? Why take the approach of nostalgia?
It seemed natural. When you're going back over your childhood, it is nostalgic. And I had a distinct challenge in writing this memoir. I was faced with the aspect that I had a happy childhood. You know, what are you going to do with that? Because you don't have the conflict of the dysfunctional family, the drug addicts, the abusive father and mother, and so forth. So I never really consciously thought it would be nostalgic, but I suppose it is.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Joe McDougall, whose voice you're hearing, whose book, Daddy's Money, a memoir of farm and family, we're talking about. It's about growing up on an Arkansas rice farm and coming of age during the age of gradual urbanization. Kansas City, we like to hear your farm stories and how growing up on a farm influenced the values you have today. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also on Twitter at KCURCST. Joe McDougall, you come from both a poetic and scholastic writing background, having taught creative writing at Pittsburgh State and being a former board member of the Writer's Place here in Kansas City. Who should actually write a memoir and why?
That is a wonderful question. There was a reviewer in the New York Times book review that gave four reasons why not to write a memoir, why not to write one. You shouldn't write one if you don't have a unique story. You shouldn't write one to get revenge. You shouldn't write one if you can't write. And you should not bore your reader with all your terrible things that happened to you.
So it shouldn't necessarily be a purging or one long diary entry either.
It should not be for revenge. And even though, as you know from reading the book, and thank you, Jabulani, for reading the book entirely.
I read it cover to cover.
I appreciate that. There was a great deal of conflict. Even though I had a happy childhood, there was a great deal of conflict with my mother and father because they were young. I thought they were old, but they were young parents. They had arguments, and then more conflict later with my sister over the settling of the estate. And there's a lot of bitterness there, and we are now estranged. But had I written the book to get revenge on my sister, I think it would have been terribly boring to any reader.
It might have been, but I noticed throughout the book you sort of weave back and forth like a period piece, very cinematic in nature, where you're going from the 30s back to the mid-90s where you're in probate court. And we'll get to those specific aspects of your life and essentially how people bought the farm. Essentially, yeah. We have a comment on Facebook from Pepwee who writes, I didn't grow up on a farm per se, but with avid gardeners as parents, this, I think, made me appreciate working with individual plants hands-on and led me to become more interested in permaculture and growing food sustainably. And now it has led me to believe I can change the world. It empowered me. Joe McDougall, did growing up on a farm empower you?
Wonderful question. Yes, I think it did. It empowered me in that I became aware of my abilities to write. And that is, of course, an empowerment, as any writer knows. Despite all the rejection slips, it's a great power to be able to write a line that you think is halfway good. I was empowered later on by knowing at one time that my whole family was in farming, and I married a farmer, and we were in rice farming until the 80s. And at that time, we were maybe like 2% of, we were included in that 2% of the population that farmed. And I always thought that was very interesting, and I felt good about that. Empowered in the fact that farming teaches you a certain resilience toward life. You go by the seasons, you're going to suffer years when you don't make any money, years when you do make money.
Feast and famine is what.
Feast and famine is what, and it's a gamble. And so a farmer learns how to go with the punches.
Is it also fair to say that you gain a certain power of observation when you're sitting out there with miles of topography around, miles of scenery around, quietness, stillness?
Yeah. I think that's what empowered me to become a writer. I had a lot of silence. There wasn't any TV. There weren't a lot of distractions, and I had the freedom. We didn't have to worry then like people do now about where their children are. I was just on the farm somewhere, wading through the dust, singing my songs, thinking my thoughts, counting out the syllables on my fingers.
We mentioned feast or famine and the life of a farmer as sort of up and down, topsy-turvy. Let's talk about the boom times that sort of set the stage for rice farming in DeWitt, Arkansas, where you're from, your hometown. It was the sort of rice fever, as it was described in Arkansas in the late 19th and early 20th century, but that fever wasn't a bad thing. It was actually a boom time that your grandfather, a Belgian immigrant, came smack dab to in the region. Tell us about that.
Well, my grandfather came from Belgium. He was one of seven children, and he and his parents, so that were, there were nine people that uprooted themselves to come to America for a better life and settled in New Orleans and years later went on up to Crowley, Louisiana, where that at that time was the seat of rice farming in the United States. And the Arkansas farmers would go down to Louisiana to learn how to grow rice. And this is where my grandfather learned how to grow rice. And then how he got to Arkansas, there's a passage in one chapter where I talk about that.
And it just so happens you're going to read
it. It just so happens I have it right here. He had an older brother named Adolf, my Uncle Adolf, who was a dreamer and a visionary. And Adolf spotted a poster one day in the Cotton Belt Depot down in Crowley, Louisiana. And it said that land on Arkansas's Grand Prairie was available, virgin, and cheap. The poster promised excursion trains that would take prospective buyers to Arkansas for a look. I don't know how he managed it, but Adolf was always a good talker. My grandfather got on one of those trains. The agent showed them the land at the end of the line. The year was 1906. The 19th century had just slipped into the 20th. World War I had not yet begun. And my grandfather must have heard the siren's call. He sold his Crowley acreage, bought the land near DeWitt, and moved to Arkansas.
That is an excerpt from the memoir Daddy's Money, a memoir of farm and family. Our guest is Joe McDougall, the author of that memoir. Kansas City, we'd like to hear your farm stories and how growing up on a farm influenced the values you have today. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We're also available via Facebook for your comments and email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Twitter is at @KCURCST. As you mentioned in that passage, Joe McDougall, your father followed in the footsteps of your grandfather, not so much reluctantly, but as part of the tradition. This is what was done. The farm was passed down. So how did that happen? And then talk about your response to that as a kid growing up.
Well, my grandfather retired early, and he was the one who had carved out the farm from the Grand Prairie. And by the way, the Grand Prairie was called that in Arkansas because it was flat as this tabletop. It had no trees, and it was covered with thick prairie grass. So those early farmers had to dig out the, get down to that virgin land through that grass. But then the farm was left to my father, and he did somewhat reluctantly take it over because my father was very interested in research and had worked at a local rice branch experiment station and worked on the varieties of rice. But he couldn't buck the tradition and the family expectation that he would take over the farm. So at 25, he took over the responsibility of the farm and moved us there, and I was 1 year old. So I never knew any other life. And we moved into the farmhouse. It was built in 1910. So it's now over 100 years old, still standing. And that's where my life began.
Talk about those different varieties of rice that you say your father studied at the horticultural level. There were different names for the rice crops, such as the mortgage lifter.
Mortgage lifter, just wonderful varieties. Some were named after girlfriends or wives. There was Edith. There was Blue Bonnet. There was
Zenith.
Zenith. Zenith became very popular as I was. That's what my father liked to use. But I love Mortgage Lifter.
Yeah, me too. I was struck by Mortgage Lifter. What does that mean? Does it mean that the price of your land will go up because of this great crop or what?
It means if you plant this variety, you might get out from under your mortgage. You might be able to pay that farm off.
But Arkansas, in fact, became the number one producer of rice in the nation, and there was a sense of pride in your household and on the Grand Prairie because of that distinction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a lot of research in a book that was written by a rice farmer who decided he would set down the history of rice farming, and it's called The Beginning of the Rice Industry in Arkansas. And he describes the perfect conditions for growing rice, and this is how Arkansas became the great state. He says that one farmer wrote, "All you have to do is tickle this land, and it will laugh a crop of rice. Virgin ground, ample water, land that had never been touched by a plow, and a lake of water underneath that couldn't be pumped dry." So rice farming in Arkansas began in 1897, and by 1904 was a big business and attracting people to get into it because it was like a gold rush.
And your grandfather Garreau said something that became very famous over time about that damn salt water.
Right.
What did he say about that damn salt water?
Well, my grandfather, he and his brother-in-law lost two crops in a row in Louisiana because the salt water permeated that water that watered the rice. And, of course, it burned the rice. And my grandfather said, "I'm moving to higher ground where the damn salt water can't get at the rice."
And he did move to higher ground.
And he moved to Arkansas.
More successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and became very successful.
We have a caller, Tamara, from Raytown. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me. I just want to comment on the thing about the solitude of being on a farm. My dad lives in Armstrong, Missouri, and we used to go every summer. And we just didn't have the distractions of television or anything. And it just gave my mind a chance to germinate. So I have the imagination that I have today.
Thank you.
Which is a great experience.
Thank you very much for your call. Tamara or Tamara?
Tamara.
Tamara. Thank you for your call, Tamara.
I
got
show.
It right. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for your call. What was the most significant discovery, speaking of what Tamara says, and speaking of what another listener, William and Lee Summit, asked you, the significant discoveries you made in writing your memoir about not having those distractions that we have today, the TV, the constant noise, the constant traffic, the constant attention deficit mm-hmm. disorder-inducing activities?
Well, I think when you write a memoir, it is a process of discovery, and I just realized how much that had meant to me. And I knew that growing up on the farm had influenced my life as a writer, but I didn't know how much till I really began to think about it. I think had I not had those early years of solitude, plus a mother who read to me every day, every night, and plus going to the Methodist Church and hearing not the new version of the Bible, but the King James Version, which I think is much more melodic, those are the things that really became part of my consciousness and influenced me to become a writer.
Those thous and these
mm-hmm.
encouraging
just
literacy.
The lyricism of it, the way it flows.
Did that influence you in your writing, in
yeah.
your poems
yes.
on the farm early there?
Yeah, I think so. I wrote my first poem when I was 12. Probably wrote some before that, but I remember this one, and it was about something on the farm. It was a really silly, stupid little poem, but my father framed it and put it on his desk. Every writer knows about ego, and that began my journey to become a poet.
What was the relationship between your mother and your father? You mentioned your mother being the nurturer in mm-hmm. terms of your literary training and distinction in the Methodist Church, your father being both the provider and caregiver and
yeah.
giving you a sort of adoration, pumping up your ego as well. What was the balance, the relationship between them?
Well, it was a wonderful balance. My father did what he thought he was supposed to do. He made the living. My mother did what she thought she was supposed to do at that time. We're talking 30s, 40s, 50s. She she did stay home, but she was an early feminist in that she had a milk and egg route in DeWitt. And I learned early on that a woman could make her own money apart from her husband.
She also majored in home economics, which is sort of a lost art and trade these days. Tell us how she employed that, not only in her entrepreneurial activities that you just mentioned, but employing that in the household and what she taught you.
Well, she taught me how to make a bed, how to do the laundry, how to cook, how to clean, all those things I don't like to do, but I know how to do them, how to prepare the meal from scratch, such as go out in the yard and get a chicken, bring it in and get it ready. She grew a humongous garden, which I hated because I had to go out and harvest the stuff in the early morning when the mosquitoes were like black lace over all over your body. But I learned those skills, and I was just fortunate to have that kind of nurturing upbringing.
And we should mention that home economics isn't exactly an easy curriculum.
No, it is not. You have to take chemistry, organic and inorganic. You have to take physics. You have to take biology. My mother was in classes with med students. So it's not your background. And they don't call it that anymore. Of course, they call it life science or something. But it's not a course whereby you just go and learn how to cook and sew and catch a husband.
It's much more than that.
It's much more than that.
It's running the home.
It's running a home. It's learning to be a good consumer. It's child development that went into that, too. And then my mother had to run the home management house at the University of Arkansas, where she went to school. And that was quite a chore.
Our guest is Joe McDougall, whose memoir is titled Daddy's Money, A Memoir of Farm and Family. Kansas City, we'd like to hear your farm stories and how growing up on a farm either influenced your values you have today or shaped your cooking habits or your eating habits. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're going to pause now for a quick break. When we return, we're going to discuss how race, class, and family tussles tended to, shall we say, crop up as time passes. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Like hyenas catching the scent, the descendants gather to maul the carcass, stocks, bonds, fields, owed rent, the Midas flesh of their father. Words from the poem titled Delta Courtroom, They Settled the Estate. That poem appears in the book Daddy's Money, A Memoir of Farm and Family, written by Joe McDougall, our guest today live in the studio, who recounts her time growing up on an Arkansas rice farm and the heartbreak that ensued when the family farm changed hands after the death of her parents. Kansas City, we'd like to hear your farm stories and how growing up on a farm or having your parents grow up on a farm influenced the values you have today. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Mary Jo, what makes the rural experience so poetic for you?
I think sense of place. I'm very much into sense of place as a poet and a writer, and I had ample time to observe the place that I was in, and as I grew older to look at it objectively and see that it was a rather unique place. It was my Yoknapatawpha County. It was my world, and very few people have the chance to grow up in that kind of environment, that kind of farming world.
And, Joe, there was a time when most Americans in the late 19th century and even early parts of the 20th century actually grew up on farms or at least in rural areas and small towns. Now it's predominantly cities and suburbs. How do you feel, both as a writer and someone who's lived in both atmospheres, how do you feel this demographic shift has changed the American mosaic?
Oh, I think it's changed it in a number of ways. I don't think we talk to each other as much. I don't think we write letters anymore. And had it not been for my mother keeping all of the letters that almost she ever got from my father during their courtship from her mother, I wouldn't have had the rich sources that I had for the memoir. But we don't communicate verbally anymore. We text too much instead of talking to each other. We don't sit down on the front porch anymore and tell each other stories. What a shame.
No, not enough time to do those things anymore, and it is sort of a shame. What was it like, speaking of that time period, what was it like to live through the Depression era and during the World War II commodities rationing period? What was the mood in the town? What can we learn today from that period, Joe?
Well, you learn, as I mentioned before, resilience. And as a child, you don't think too much about it. You go with whatever's handed you. But I will remember the slogan, "Is this trip really necessary?" Because gas was rationed. I remember that my mother grew even more vegetables in her garden, called it her victory garden. I remember the rationing stamps we had to get sugar and coffee and those luxuries, nylon hose. Girls, the older girls, I wasn't old enough to even think about wearing hose then, but the older girls, because nylons, stockings were so scarce, would paint a black seam with a black marker of some sort up the back of the calves of their legs because stockings had seams then. And that would fool people into thinking that they were wearing stockings.
I imagine you had to be mighty fine with a pin to go that fine to make it look like a seam.
Well, you look, if you can find the old examples of the stockings, those seams were fairly visible, pretty visible.
Were there ever situations where the marker got smudged?
I'm sure. Or you couldn't draw it straight.
We're going to go to Dean, who's calling in from just north of St. Joseph.
Good morning.
Hello. Welcome to Central Standard.
Sounds like a great book. Where can we buy it?
Well, I'm so glad you asked the question. You can buy it at your local independent booksellers. You can buy it from Amazon.com.
Okay.
Buy it from straight from the University of Arkansas Press, my wonderful publishers, by calling 1-800-926. I'm sorry, I don't know the number.
You can call that number.
Yeah.
Dean, do you have a question?
Yes, I don't really have a question. I have a comment.
Please give us that comment.
Growing up in rural America, and for the last 38 years, I've been a teacher of agricultural education on the high school level. You will see the students today that have grown up on the farm have a whole different set of values than the students that grow up in the urban setting.
Really?
And the rural setting, you knew if you got up in the morning and you didn't work, money was not going to be made for the farm.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't go out and do your chores and those type of things. Those are pounded into you the rest of your life. I'm 60 years old now, and I still sit down and worry, gee, should I really buy this? Do I really need it? And those values came to me 50 years ago, and sometimes we don't see that today. And rural agriculture does set the scene for a lot of successful young men and ladies. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean, for those comments and that contribution to this conversation about how growing up in an agrarian society shifts and influences your values as you grow up. You mentioned that, Joe, in asking during the World War II rationing period, is this trip really necessary?
Mm-hmm.
Is this amount of food really necessary?
Mm-hmm.
He mentions if the chores don't get done, you don't eat.
Well, I thought his comments were right on. And I think the Midwestern values are rooted probably in just what he's talking about. And I really noticed it when I moved to the Midwest. I've been here, well, of course, I've been here many years. And there is such a work ethic here. I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but Midwesterners have a true work ethic. And I think it comes from either being brought up on the farm or having relatives on the farm, somehow knowing the rigors of farm life.
Well, let's talk about one of the values and morals that is prevalent in the Midwest and in the South and Deep South that doesn't necessarily show a lighter side
right.
of values. And that's the passage in your book, Daddy's Money, when you write, although as a child you didn't consider your parents racist, some people probably would. You said, and I quote, they lazed along with the status quo. What does that mean to you? Lazing along, to laze along with the status quo. You're talking about the legacy of racism and perhaps lynchings and murders in that area of DeWitt, Arkansas.
Well, we're talking 30s, 40s, 50s, when segregation was quite, quite prominent. And my mother and father, I wish, had taken more of a stand against it. They weren't overt in their beliefs, but they didn't challenge it either. And I remember I would challenge my mother because we had a black lady working for us.
Beulah, was it?
Beulah. And she always used the outhouse in the back of the yard. She didn't use our bathroom. She didn't sit down to eat with us. And I thought, I was 9 or 10 then, and I questioned my mother. And mother said, well, she wouldn't have it any other way. That's just the way it's done. And I said, but it isn't right. And mother just would not discuss it.
Her response, as I recall reading that passage, it just isn't done.
It just isn't done. And that was, I think, the response all through the South. Many, many people didn't have the courage to go against the status quo, which was separate but laughingly equal. There's nothing equal about it. It was all separate.
You also said something very striking about the beauty and topography of that region, bayous, as it were, that you didn't witness any lynchings with your own eyes, but you heard a lot of stories about the bodies of black men turning up in bayous in and around that county.
There, of course, there were a lot of bayous, and there were a lot of ditches and a lot of bypasses from the rivers. And occasionally we would hear of a body that was in a that had been found in a bayou, and the question would always be black or white. And if the answer was black, nobody questioned who it was. If it was white, well, then, of course, you wanted to know. But then if it was a black body, there was usually no investigation by the authorities. I thought that was somewhat wrong, too.
And as you grew up, how did that shape your values, even as you reconciled them with the hard work ethic and honest work ethic of your mother and father?
Well, I think I vowed not to be racist in any way, and I vowed to create create an atmosphere in my own life where I would treat everybody equally. Now, going to public school was also a good lesson in treating everybody equally, although, of course, we had no black people in school.
And speaking of that, wasn't it a question of exposure for you as well? You hadn't actually met a single black person until this woman, Beulah, and you were almost in your late teens.
Yeah.
How does that shape somebody's perception?
Well, you have a lot to learn. And when civil rights finally came about and integration finally came about and I was married and began to have black people into my home, one young black man cautioned me, and he said, you know, don't be so accepting of everyone. We're not all wonderful. He said, you're too naive. But, it did shape me. Because in stores when I was growing up, no matter if I was the third or fourth one to come to the cash register, if a black person should be finished before I was and ready to make the purchase, they always deferred to me and insisted that I go first. So it shapes your life, and you have a lot to unlearn about that.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Joe McDougal, whose memoir, Daddy's Money, a memoir of farm and family. We're talking about that. Mm-hmm. It's about growing up on an Arkansas rice farm and coming of age during an age of Jim Crow segregation, during an age of farm and agrarian life, and during the age of gradual urbanization. Kansas City, we'd like to hear your farm stories and how growing up on a farm influenced the values you have today. 816-235-2888 is the number. That's 816-235-2888. Donnie in KC. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you. I can't wait to read the book. But I'm 50 years old, but my great-great-grandfather's homesteaded land in Yell County, Arkansas. And I love hearing the stories when my father moved to Kansas City in the 50s and married my mother, who came from a farm family also. He was a sharecropper, my dad's family was. And when he was a kid growing up, that's what they did. They picked cotton. But every vacation from school, we would go down there and visit my grandparents and spend a lot of time. But the values that, you know, they instilled in me and my other grandparents who farmed, you know, just lasted forever. Both my parents are teachers, and I'm a teacher. My sister's a teacher. And, you know, I think kids today just really miss out on a very important value system growing up on the farm. My sister is now a new farm owner, and she's going to retire as a college professor and move back to the farm and have a green farm. So
thank you.
I just really enjoy it. I Arkansas is really close to my heart. I can't wait to read your book.
Thank you
very much. Thank you very much, Donnie. Talk about that, maybe considering going back to farming after growing up in farming and seeing it dissipate and seeing it disintegrate, and then people are going back to that.
She mentioned the green farm, so there's the way it's evolving in a good direction. I still do own some acreage in Arkansas, farm acreage, and it's good to know it's there. It's some place to go back to. My grown grandchildren like to hunt and fish there in the reservoir. But everything changes, but the more things change, the more they stay the same. So farming values pretty much stay the same. But the green farm, and the organic farming, that's a new twist and a very positive direction for farming to take.
Let's talk about the significance of your red wagon as a child through the auction of your parents' assets and what that red wagon means today. How does that encapsulate the entire experience?
Well, the red wagon was the thing that was a great source of amusement and happiness when I was growing up. And my father employed two faithful hired men to help him on the farm. And one of them, named Bill, was my buddy. And every summer morning, I would go out to my father's shop and beg Bill to take me for a ride in the wagon, and we developed a route around the gas pump, around the barn, up to the house and back again. And years later, when my sister and I were having our difficulties and we were in a tussle over the estate, and a bank had taken the estate administration over and ordered an auction of farm belongings, we went my son and I went to the auction and went into my father's shop, and the auctioneer was auctioning off the little red wagon, which by then was rusted and missing a wheel or two. And I wanted it very badly just because it was my childhood. And a man was standing next to me and kept outbidding me, but then he realized that I was one of the heirs. And he said, "Was that your red wagon?" And I said, "Yes," and he stopped bidding. But then from the back of the crowd came my sister's bid, an outrageous price, and I lost the wagon.
After your dad's death, mm-hmm. you say distance. You just mentioned your sister outbidding you on the red wagon as if you were little children, almost.
Well, that's kind of what it was.
Right. You mention the distance between you and your siblings beginning to emerge. Are you more clear about it now than you were at the time in the early 1990s when this auction was going on? When did you begin to become estranged from your siblings? After your father's death, was it?
Well, I only have one sibling, my sister, and we became estranged about a year or two after my father's death, when I began to see her doing things with the estate that I just couldn't possibly approve of or sustain. And so I took her to court for my share of the inheritance, and that began the estrangement. which exist, unfortunately, even now.
Still today.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, and I quote, time had pillaged and raped, that your old home place looked like the setting for a Tennessee Williams play, Genteel Old Decay in the South. Where are you coming from with this very critical, graphic assessment of what eventually became of your place in childhood?
Well, the farm, the land is still being farmed. It's out of the family now, but it is still being farmed. But there is a portion of the land where the homestead and the barn and all the outbuildings are. And no one has lived there since 1990, probably 92 or so. And the house has been vacant and dilapidated and almost willingly disappearing, as if it wants to disappear. And I went back there and took a photographer with me so I'd have a record of it. And all the bushes were grown up and the shutters were awry and the hangdog roof and the disinterested paint just made me very, very sad.
You mentioned declining as if it's supposed to.
Yes, if it wants to.
I recall a passage from the book where your father is reacting with the inevitability of decline when your mother dies. Talk about that.
My father resisted that inevitability very much. He wanted the house to become, and everything in it to become, a shrine to my mother. She died about 9 years before he did. And he lived on in the house. He would not let us, me or my sister, touch a thing, remove one thing, have anything from it, which I never quite understood. But, of course, he saw his own health declining. He eventually had to move from the farm. He had wanted to die on his tractor. That was his wish.
That's what he said he would do.
Said he would do. He would never retire. He would die on his tractor. But he had to retired because of developing cancer and had to leave.
You said he pretty much died almost kicking and screaming.
Oh, he never reconciled himself to the fact that he would die. And he went kicking and screaming into that good night. He didn't go gentle. Dylan Thomas would have been proud of him.
He raged against the dying of the light, as it were.
He raged against it. Yes, he did.
We got Tracy in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I'm enjoying the show. I'm looking forward to reading the book. My mother and her family were sharecroppers in southeast Missouri, in the Missouri Boot Heel. And just a couple of comments I was going to make, and I've been waiting on the phone for a while, so my apologies if the comments now are about topics that you've all moved on from. But one of them is I now teach college courses in food ethics, politics, and culture. And one of the topics that we cover is the Missouri roadside sharecropper strike that happened in the Missouri Boot Heel in 1939. And it was organized by a black sharecropper named Reverend Owen Whitfield with the help of a lot of other people, among them Thad Snow, who was a white landowner in that time. And secondly, about your grandfather wanting to die on his tractor, my grandfather was diagnosed with heart disease, and he was instructed by his doctors to quit farming. He came home and sat down with my grandmother and informed her, "Dory, I'm just not going to do that. So I am going to die in the fields."
Yeah.
And he did indeed farm up until the day that he died.
Right.
So those were my comments. I am enjoying the show very much, and I think that the race relations between blacks and whites in that area of that time is something that is undercovered. And I also think that the role of black Americans as farmers, as self-sufficient, independent farmers, is something that would be wonderful to see more work done with.
Thank you, Tracy, for your comments. You touch on some of that a little bit in your book, because your father wasn't exactly a rich industrialist planter, but very, very well-to-do, especially when he took advantage of some of the more shrewd cultivation and mm-hmm. and work ethic patterns mm-hmm. that belie successful farming.
Yeah. Well, we were middle class. We were in the middle class. her comments, the last caller, those are great comments of, about the undercoverage of black farmers. There were black farmers that we knew of that had their own land and were successful, but I imagine even though they were successful, they probably had a great deal of trouble getting crop loans, more trouble than white farmers. And, yeah, I hope someone will write about that. That's fascinating.
Debbie emails us to share, "I wish I could preserve family members for the generations to come. How do you suggest one begin to gather the details and refresh the memories so that they can be woven into a memoir?"
Ah, great question. Well, first of all, if you have people still living that you know have stories, rush to them right away and get them. Record them. Don't wait. Anything can happen, and they may go without you getting the stories. That's my one regret. I didn't have sense enough in my 20s and 30s to question these people that I should have. Hope that you're born into a family of hoarders and that you have a treasure of letters and family photographs. There are over 20 pages of photographs in this book, gathered from the fact that my mother didn't throw anything away.
Joe McDougall, whose memoir, Daddy's Money, A Memoir of Farm and Family, is about growing up on an Arkansas rice farm and coming of age during the age of gradual urbanization. A good, brisk read. It's in stores now and on Amazon, as you mentioned. Miss McDougall, thank you for joining us here on Central Standard.
Thank you for having me, Jabalani.
And tune in tomorrow for a show about a glimpse into the life of FBI agents and private investigators. We'll tell you about the show, but that information is top secret. Get your trench coats and hats out for that one. We had help today from Tamika Witherspoon. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi. Up to Date is next with an encore broadcast of their conversation about the very preventable death of President James Garfield. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.